Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 881474, United States against Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company.
This is the most unmanageable.
Mr. Horwich, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue in this case concerns the construction of Section 902 of the Foreign Tax Credit Provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. This section allows a U.S. corporation to take a credit against the U.S. income tax that is due on certain dividend income that it receives. Specifically, the issue concerns the definition of the important term accumulated profits in Section 902. In a case where the tax laws of the foreign country establish different rules for the computation of profits than do the tax laws of the United States. In this case, the British tax laws entitled respondent to take two large deductions from its income, totaling more than £3 million. The parties have stipulated at page 23 of the joint appendix that these deductions would not be allowable under U.S. tax laws. The Federal Circuit in this case upset the well-settled rule that the term accumulated profits is to be defined in accordance with U.S. tax principles, and instead held that it should be determined in accordance with the tax principles of the foreign country. We believe that the Court of Appeals holding is clearly wrong and completely undermines the statutory purpose. To explain why that is so, I'd like to begin by describing the statutory framework out of which this case arises. When a U.S. company engages in business in a foreign country, it is likely to be subjected to tax by the foreign country on the income that it earns there. When it reports this income on its U.S. tax return, the code allows it to take a credit to reflect the foreign tax that's already been paid on the income, and thereby to avoid double taxation of the same income. There are two different ways in which a U.S. company can do business abroad, and they require distinct treatment in the code. But the goal, which everyone agrees here, is that more or less the two different ways of business should be treated the same under the code, and there should be no advantage of doing one way of doing business over the other for foreign tax credit purposes.
That is more or less agreed?
I understand that to be agreed, yes. The simplest case is when the U.S. company operates what's called a branch operation in the foreign country. That means that there is just one corporation, no separate taxable entity in the foreign country. The income that is earned in the foreign country flows directly to the U.S. company, and it is reported directly on its return as income. And the U.S. company then gets what is called a direct credit under Section 901. The amount of foreign tax that it paid to the foreign country on that income is directly credited on its U.S. return. Now, it's significant to note here that all that happens is that the U.S. company takes a number, the amount of British tax that it paid, and puts it on its U.S. return. It's not concerned, and the U.S. tax authorities are not concerned, with how the foreign government computed that tax. It could be at a given rate on the same kind of income that the United States rules would apply, or it could be at a lower rate with a different computation of United States income. But that makes no difference to the branch's reporting on its U.S. return. Now, the other method of doing business overseas would be through a separately incorporated subsidiary. In that case, you have a different corporation operating in the foreign country, and it is that corporation, not the U.S. parent, that pays the foreign tax. The income that is earned by that foreign corporation, by the same token, does not automatically flow to the U.S. parent. It is earned by the foreign company, and two things can happen to that income. Either it can be distributed down to the U.S. parent as a dividend. Now, the dividend, as you probably know, is defined in the Internal Revenue Code as a distribution that is made out of earnings and profits. It's defined by Sections 316 and 312 of the Code. If it's distributed as a dividend to the U.S. company, it is then reported as income on the U.S. parent's tax return, and it is subjected to U.S. tax. On the other hand, the foreign subsidiary may retain the income, not distribute it to the U.S. parent. In that case, the income stays in the foreign sub, and it is immunized from U.S. taxation. Section 902 is designed to provide an appropriate credit to deal with the subsidiary situation. It is called the deemed paid credit because it gives the U.S. parent a credit for foreign tax that it is deemed to have paid, the foreign tax actually having been paid by the subsidiary. And the goals of Section 902 are to provide the appropriate credit. That means to both to avoid double taxation and to avoid undertaxation, so as not to give the subsidiary operation an advantage over the branch operation. Now, I think the boundaries of how Section 902 should operate are fairly clear. The credit should not be available when all of the sub's earnings are not distributed. If they're retained in the foreign subsidiary, there should be no credit at that point to the U.S. parent. Because none of the earnings have been subjected to U.S. taxation, there's nothing to credit against and no possibility of double taxation. On the other hand, when all of the foreign earnings, the earnings earned by the foreign sub, have been distributed to the parent, at that point, all of the foreign tax that was paid on those earnings should be credited to the U.S. company. At that point, that is the close analogy to the branch operation. When all of the sub's earnings have been distributed to the parent, it is pretty much in the same position as would have been a branch, the branch having gotten the full credit from the start, that the U.S. parent should now get the full credit. Now, the complication that we have to deal with in this case arises when the subsidiary distributes only a portion of its earnings and retains some of the others. Clearly, some sort of a partial credit must be given to the parent in that situation, and the code's mechanism for doing that is the allocation formula that we have here in Section 902. Now, the formula is set forth on page 4 of our brief. It's a fairly simple formula. It sets up a ratio. The numerator of the ratio is the dividends that are paid to the U.S. parent, and the denominator is defined as the accumulated profits of the foreign corporation. That is after-tax accumulated profits. Now, it is our submission that the profits in the denominator of the fraction must be computed according to U.S. tax principles, just as the profits are that govern the determination of the amount of dividends that will be reported as income on the U.S. return. That is the two things that are being compared and the necessary correlation. The whole point of the formula is to compare the amount of the sub's profits that have been distributed and therefore subjected to U.S. taxation with the amount of the sub's profits that have been retained in the sub and therefore still immunized from U.S. taxation. For the formula to work properly, the denominator must reflect the total amount that is available for distribution to the U.S. parent as a dividend, and that number is the profits as determined under U.S. law. Now, there's one other point that I want to explain about the statutory framework, and that is the notion of sourcing, which respondent discusses at great length in his brief. It is possible, if the subsidiary does not distribute the earnings as they are earned year by year, but instead accumulates the earnings for a period of time, that in some year it will make a large distribution of earnings that are greater than its earnings in that particular year. The code provides that these earnings are to be sourced on a year, the dividend distributed is to be sourced on a year-by-year basis to the earnings of each year. And this is done according to the statute, Section 902C1, under what we call the LIFO system. That is, you start with the current year and then go back year by year, exhausting the earnings as you go. So, for example, if the subsidiary had earned $800 in a particular year and that year distributed $1,000, but it had accumulated earnings from previous years, then $800 of that distribution would be treated by the code as a distribution in the current year. And the extra $200 would be treated as a distribution of profits earned in the previous year. And the tax credit calculation would then be kind of a two-step calculation. They would get the full credit for the current year of all the foreign tax they paid in that year because all of the profits for that year were distributed, and then they would be treated as having made a $200 distribution in the previous year and would get a foreign tax credit given to them by the formula for that year.
Well, Mr. Horowitz, I guess you have conceded that at least in one circumstance where there are no profits under the application of U.S. tax principles for a year, and yet the foreign subsidiary has paid a tax, that there's nothing by way of a credit, and there is, in effect, double taxation.
That's correct. We discussed that point at some length in our reply brief, Justice O'Connor.
Well, that certainly is a concern.
Well, it is a concern. It is something that arises out of the mathematics that when you multiply anything by zero, what you get is zero. I should say that it's...
Is there no way that the IRS in that situation could devise a means of recognizing foreign losses and carrybacks or something, or some mechanism for adjusting so that you achieve the purpose of the...
Yes, there may well be. As far as I know, there's never been any that issue has never come up in litigation, or litigation that has at least gone to a decision. There was a recent article in Tax Notes, which I got a copy of in the mail, and I gather the court got a copy of in the mail also, which cites a lot of commentators and mentions that a couple of the commentators, although they agree with the government's basic position here that U.S. tax principles govern, believe that there should be some way of taking account of foreign carryback rules. That's a separate issue. That's a detail at the margins of the issue, I think, that's presented in this case, and I don't think it's necessary for the court to get into it here. I think the zero income question.
Yes, but it is a concern if you know that the rule you adopt is going to result in some defeating of the statutory goal in some circumstances.
Well, I guess I'm not acknowledging that, Justice O'Connor, because the zero, as a practical matter, the zero income case is not going to come up except in the area of a loss carryback. I mean, there's not going to be a case where they're subjected to a lot of foreign tax, and yet there's absolutely no U.S. income for that year. All the examples that are given by the amici and by the respondent all involve cases where there's a deviation in the carryback rules of a loss.
And how do the taxpayers here get in difficulty with the application of your principle? How are the taxpayers here adversely affected?
Well, they're not adversely affected at all. They're trying to get a tremendous tax benefit from the rule that they apply. There's clearly no zero income problem in this case, and there's no issue of carryback in this case. As I said before, it's stipulated that the tremendous deductions that they got under British law here are not available at all under U.S. law. But just to finish my answer to your question before, I mean, the zero income thing can come up where the carrybacks are made to different years under the different tax systems. And what I was just pointing out is that there is more of an argument there that the general principle that U.S. tax principles apply to the definition of profits might be adjusted by that for carrybacks that is made by several commentators. So I don't think the decision in this case is going to resolve that one way or another. That would be left for further litigation.
Is your position embodied in a Treasury regulation?
Our position in this case? Yes, there's section 109.
This is in a Treasury regulation.
Yes. Well, the Treasury regulation is not very detailed. It says that accumulated profits are determined according to earnings and profits of the corporation.
Under United States law?
Yeah, under United States law.
Is that what it says?
Yes. Well, it uses the term earnings and profits, which is a United States concept and which is understood to mean United States principles.
In other words, the regulation is ambiguous in the same way the statute is.
No, I don't think it's ambiguous in the same way the statute is because the regulation uses a term of art of United States tax law, earnings and profits, which is the base in which U.S. dividends are paid out of. The statute uses a term, accumulated profits, which appears nowhere else in the code, doesn't have an established meaning, and is, for these purposes, is not defined by the code, so it's left to the parties to fight over what it means. But accumulated profits is not a term of art in the same sense that earnings and profits is. It is our argument that it should mean pretty much the same thing.
It's their argument that it's very suggestive that they used a word that isn't used anywhere else in the code instead of just using earnings and profits, which makes some sense.
Not too much sense, Justice Scalia. I mean, it was necessary to come up with some term there because we are talking about a foreign corporation here. So to just say earnings and profits would not be meaningful because foreign corporations.
It only makes sense in the Treasury regulation. It wouldn't have made sense in the statute.
Well, in the Treasury regulation.
I don't see why it makes any less sense and any more sense in the Treasury reg. You just told us it's very clear what it means in the Treasury reg, that there's no ambiguity. Justice Kennedy said that's ambiguous. He said, no, that's not ambiguous.
Well, I guess the Treasury reg is issued in the context of a lot of rulings and court decisions already that have discussed this issue. But as far as the intent of Congress in using this phrase, I think I should make clear that it's not the government's contention that the Congress in 1918 or 1921 sat down and considered the question whether these profits will be determined in accordance with U.S. law or in accordance with foreign law, and then decided to use the term accumulated profits. I don't think there's any reason to think that the issue occurred to the Congress, that there would possibly be a difference. I think what we know what the intent of the Congress was generally in enacting the credit, and our position is that only by using U.S. profits can that intent be effectuated. Obviously, if Congress was aware of this litigation, had the prescience to know that this litigation, they would have used a different word no matter who was right. In this case, they wouldn't have used something ambiguous.
I suppose that, all you have to say is that your construction of the statute is a defensible one or a reasonable one, even if there's another construction?
Well, to the extent, the administrative construction is entitled to deference. I guess we tend to rely on those cases where we think there's a reasonable argument on the other side. In this case, I think it's so clear that the only way of reading the statute is the government's that will save that ammunition for another case. But I agree with you, Justice Murphy. There are two ways in which the variation in accumulated profits can affect the computation of the credit. One is in the allocation ratio, that is the formula that I quoted before, for a given year, for a single year's profits. If the number in the denominator is changed, and as they have done in this case, if the number in the denominator is reduced by using a smaller foreign definition of profits, that will necessarily increase the ratio and the amount of credits that you get for a particular distribution. The second way that it can make a difference is in connection with this sourcing mechanism that I spoke of before. If the accumulated profits are smaller, then a given distribution of earnings, which is what happened here, can swallow up the earnings of a given year sooner, thus resulting in a full credit for that year, and get back to earlier years and end up soaking up more of the credit, so to speak. But both of those factors are present in this case and affected the tax computation. There are a lot of numbers in the joint appendix here on schedules, but I would just call the Court's attention to pages 30 and 31, which are, I think, the key schedules, include the different computations of both parties. And
have to decide it.
Not in this case, but we're talking general principles. If there were any difference between whether the receipt of the money constituted a dividend or not, if there were a difference between U.S. and British law, do you concede that it would be U.S. law that would govern?
If the dividend for under U.S. law would have, let's say, if Goodyear England had been a U.S. corporation, and a distribution had been made to its parent. The question whether that distribution is a dividend or is a capital distribution is a matter of U.S. law, if there is any difference of opinion on that point.
But you say there happens to have been none in this case.
There happens to have been none in this case. Now, it might be worth mentioning this at this point because there was something said about this which I think is a little confusing, about the possibility that the distribution made that the possibility that the foreign income tax base might have been less than or more than the amount of the taxable dividend or of the earnings and profits, and what the effect might have been. And the fact of it is that under the theory, as we understand it to be, if the accumulated profits, in any sense of the word, should exceed the foreign income tax base and the dividend also exceeded that amount, then you would carry it back. But if it went the other way around, you would not, because you would have exhausted the earnings and profits in the dividend you paid, and there isn't anything left to carry back. So that it's not quite right to say that 316 is governing it in either case. Now, in arguing that the term accumulated profits means the foreign tax base, Goodyear relies first on the wording of the statute, second on the decided cases, then on the fact that any other view produces distortions in the credit allowed, whether or not we have any 0 years, and finally on the fact that practical difficulties appear in applying any contrary rule. Section 902A1, when it sets out the formula, refers to the foreign taxes paid by the foreign corporation on or with respect to the accumulated profits. This seems to me to suggest that accumulated profits means the foreign tax base, because the taxes are paid on or with respect to that amount. But Section 902 goes on and defines accumulated profits. I'm going to read part of it. For purposes of this section, the term accumulated profits means, with respect to any foreign corporation, the amount of its gains, profits, or income computed without reduction by the amount of the income, war profits, and excess profits taxes imposed on or with respect to such profits or income by any foreign country or any possession of the United States. Literally, that says that accumulated profits means gains, profits, or income, because it says it means gains, profits, or income, not adjusted. Our problem now shifts to finding out what gains, profits, or income means. The language is clear. Surely, if the foreign taxes are imposed on or with respect to the gains, profits, or income, then the gains, profits, or income must necessarily be the amount on which the foreign tax was imposed. The statute has now told us the same thing twice. Accumulated profits and gains, profits, and income are the same thing, and both represent the amount on or with respect to which the foreign tax was imposed, that is, the foreign tax base. The foreign country doesn't impose its tax on or with respect to the income recomputed under U.S. standards. And at that point, I'd like to say an aside about part of the argument that was made here for the government, and that is, we have not agreed that the deduction of the loss in 1970 and 71 was not allowable under U.S. rules. Under 902, we claim that it was allowable because 902 is the U.S. rule, and we think it must be taken into account because it's a part of the base. Now, the first case on this was the United Dyewood case, and the United Dyewood case said specifically, the total taxable income upon which such taxes were paid, that was the language in the 18 Act, means the sum used by the foreign government as a base to compute the foreign tax. Now, the government has pointed out that it's a dictum, but on the other hand, this was a case in which they had to apply the formula. It was a complicated matter because there were two tax bases, there being an excess profits tax as well as an ordinary income tax. So they spelled out the formula. The government had tried to add one-half to one-third and get two-fifths, which obviously wasn't very good arithmetic, and the court straightened it out and figured that the way to do it was to figure out the excess profits tax credit first, and then the income tax one, but in both cases, they clearly were talking about the foreign tax base. Now, this court decided the American Chicle case. By that time, the statute had been amended. It no longer said taxable income. It now said accumulated profits, but this court said that the accumulated profits were the total taxable profits. Taxable by whom? Obviously, taxable by the only tax authority that affected a foreign subsidiary. It certainly did not mean profits that would have been taxable in the United States if it had been taxable in the United States, which it wasn't.
Mr. Coughlin, I'm sorry, but can I interrupt you with a question? Sir. Earlier you say you quoted the language in 90C1A, gains, profits, or income, computer, and then I got the impression you were saying those same words were repeated with, were used when you described the amount on which the foreign tax base. Is that, did I understand you correctly?
Yes, it says.
And where is the other section where the same words are used? Because that's not quite the same.
It's in the same. It says gains, profits, or income, and then it says profits or income.
You read the profits or income is in 901B.
I was reading from 901. Wait till I get the exact
the language
wording.
There is income or profits and excess profits taxes. Is that what you were
it said,
your parallel?
Yes.
Okay.
The accumulated profits means the gains, profits, or income computed without reduction by the amount of the taxes imposed on or with respect to such profits or income. Now, I didn't repeat the word gains, but I think the word such is probably enough to pick up the earlier language.
Oh, I see. That's the comparison. All right. Thank you. I understand what you're
Now, when I said it had done it twice, it's because I think in the first section, when it's referred to the accumulated profits in excess of the taxes imposed on such accumulated profits, that also implies that you must be talking about foreign income because you aren't imposing a foreign tax on anything else. Now, the tax court has also reached a result that's consistent with these others.
May I disagree with that? I mean, it seems to me not a bad use of language to speak of imposing foreign taxes on the same sum of money that would have been income under United States tax law. Why is that a distorted use of language?
Because the foreign government does not impose its tax on an amount computed under U.S. terms. It imposes its tax on the foreign tax base.
That may well be, but it does impose it upon a certain sum of money. And
yes. What
the statute might be saying is that portion of that sum of money, which is income, which is taxable under U.S. law, on which that tax was imposed. I don't know why that would be. I think the language would bear it, Mr. Coughlin.
I think the language doesn't really carry it. I think the Second Circuit, the two judges Hand and Judge Swan, were correct in treating it as being the foreign tax base. The tax court has ruled that you must take into account the foreign net operating loss carryback, and both courts below, in the present case, even though one court decided its case the other way, both courts said that gains, profits, or income, as used in Section 902, means the foreign tax base.
Thank you, Mr. Coughlin. Mr. Horwitz, do you have any rebuttal? You have 2 minutes remaining.
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice. Just a couple of points. Respondent at least suggested in its argument that there might be a question whether, under the government's interpretation, Goodyear would ever get credit for all the foreign taxes that it paid. There's no question that it would. As soon as it gets around to distributing all the income that it has kept in the foreign sub, it will get credit for all the taxes that it paid. The question here is whether it can accelerate those credits without distributing the money that is available for distribution as dividends. He also suggested that, going away from the facts of this case to hypothetical situations, that the government's approach can lead to the denial of credit for all the taxes paid. That's true, as we discussed earlier, in the limited case of the zero year, but I'd like to emphasize that under Goodyear's interpretation, it is similarly true that the company can lose credit for all of the taxes that it paid, and that will happen every time the foreign income definition is higher than the U.S. government definition. And that's explained in the examples at page 22 of our brief and pages 15 to 16 of the reply brief. Now, Goodyear's not worried about that because, in their case, the foreign income is lower, and therefore it redounds to their benefit. Another point I'd like to make is that there's obviously nothing wrong with the fact that the tax here was adjusted because of the change in the British taxing. Obviously, they don't want to get I said at the outset that they don't expect to get credit for taxes that were already refunded by Great Britain. The tax is not part of the numerator of the fraction. The tax is the constant against which the fraction is multiplied, and there's no reason for there to be any correlation between the denominator and the foreign taxes. And finally, my last point, I'd just like to second what Justice Scalia said about the language of the statute. From the perspective of the U.S. tax code and the U.S. corporation, all that this language means is that you look to the income for the year, for the income on which the foreign tax is imposed is the income for that year on which the foreign tax is paid. If you look at a branch that has, say, $1,000 in income under U.S. law, it views the British tax imposed for that year as being imposed on that $1,000, and it's not concerned with how the British would compute the income, and the same should be true here.
Thank you, Mr. Horwitz. The case is submitted.
Monday next at 10 o'clock.